All right, so welcome to another deep dive, and this time we're looking at Numbers and Deuteronomy.
Oh boy, two for the price of one.
That's right.
Okay.
We're going to be unpacking a lecture from Robert Vannoy.
Okay.
And it is quite the wild rhyme.
It is. Is.
We are talking massive census figures that just seem impossible.
Yeah.
We're talking laws that might make you raise an eyebrow. Like, what happens when a husband suspects his wife has been unfaithful but has no proof?
Yeah.
Get ready, because some of this stuff might just challenge how you see the Old Testament.
It really does. I love it because it offers a glimpse into this ancient world,
right,
and how they functioned.
Yeah.
And how they grappled with questions of faith and justice and social dynamics. And sometimes those answers are very different from what we might expect today.
Okay, so let's start with the elephant in the room.
Oh, let's do it.
Or maybe I should say the elephant in the room.
Okay.
Those enormous census numbers.
Yep.
Yeah, numbers. We're told there are 600,000 fighting men.
Yep.
That means a population of millions.
Millions.
How did that even work in the ancient world?
So there are a couple of different approaches. And one of the things is that scholars will say that maybe LF doesn't always mean a literal thousand. Maybe it refers to like a clan or a military unit.
Okay.
But even then, like if you say, okay, well, LF means 50 or 100, the numbers are still way bigger than what archaeology and historical records would suggest for that time period and that location.
So is the Bible just making stuff up?
Well, not necessarily. So you've got scholars like R.K. Harrison, and what he's suggesting is that maybe ancient cultures, they just understood numbers differently. Like maybe they weren't always meant to be these precise headcounts, but instead they convey kind of a symbolic meaning. So for instance, like emphasizing the vastness of the Israelite community, the idea that they are this massive force to be reckoned with.
So it's more about like the idea of a huge, powerful nation rather than a strict headcount.
Right. And it's really fascinating because, like, even in the ancient world, you know, there are records and there are ways to figure these things out. So you can't just blow it off and say, oh, they just did numbers differently. I mean, there's something else going on there, I think, that we have yet to grasp.
Yeah. That is fascinating. But it gets even weirder when you look at the Levite census.
Oh, yeah.
22,000 Levites.
Yeah.
But 22,273 firstborn sons.
Uh-huh.
To have that many firstborns, you'd need families with dozens of kids.
Yeah, this is where it's just like, huh. Because you have scholars like J.J. Davis who points out that to make those numbers work, the average Israelite father would need something like 40 sons.
Right.
I mean, come on.
Not realistic.
Not realistic at all. So some people have tried to argue, well, maybe it's only counting firstborn sons over a specific period of time, but that actually contradicts the text.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, well, what is going on here?
So we're left with this mystery. Right?
Yeah.
The numbers are clearly important. But we might be missing, like, a layer of understanding. It's like trying to read a coded message.
Totally.
Where we only know some of the symbols.
Yeah, and that's what I love about studying these texts. It forces us to go, oh, wait, what? Like, maybe I don't know everything. Like, let me think about this in a different way.
Yeah.
Let me see it through ancient eyes.
And speaking of challenging assumptions.
Yes. Let's challenge those assumptions.
Let's talk about the law of jealousy. So imagine this. You are a husband in ancient Israel, and you suspect your wife has been unfaithful, but you have no evidence.
Yeah. What do you do? This is a problem.
What do you do?
Well, according to Numbers 5, you go to the priest, and your wife undergoes this ritual involving bitter water. Now, this water is like water mixed with dust from the tabernacle floor. And if she's guilty, this water is supposed to have some pretty nasty effects.
Sounds a little intense.
It does.
Like those trial by ordeal things.
Yeah.
You hear about in like medieval Europe.
Exactly.
Is this basically assuming the woman is guilty until proven innocent?
You know, it might seem that way at first glance, but actually it's more nuanced than that, because unlike those trials by ordeal where the accused had to like survive some dangerous test, the ritual in Numbers, it actually assumes the woman's innocence.
Oh.
Unless she's proven guilty.
By the water.
By the water.
Okay, so it's more like the burden of proof is on the accusation itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's kind of a surprising twist.
Yeah. And some scholars believe this ritual might have actually provided a measure of protection for women in a patriarchal society because it forced the husband to either produce evidence or drop the accusation.
Right.
You know, it potentially shielded the wife from slander or false claims.
So even though the ritual itself seems strange to us, it might have actually been a way to ensure, like, some level of justice
right.
in a system where women often had less power.
I think that's a really good point, because it's reminding us you can't always judge these ancient practices by our modern standards. We need to go, okay, what was happening in their culture?
Yeah.
What was happening at that time?
Okay, so let's switch gears to a different kind of vow.
Okay.
The Nazirite vow.
Yeah.
Outlined in number 6.
Yep.
This is where someone chooses to dedicate themselves to God for a specific period of time.
Right, like a spiritual boot camp.
Yeah, and there are 3 main rules.
Great rules.
No grape products.
No, no wine.
No haircuts.
And no contact with dead bodies.
It sounds pretty intense.
It does.
Compared to, you know, how we usually think about religious devotion today.
Exactly.
Like, no coffee or wine for weeks or months.
Right, that would be really hard.
That would be tough. And what's the deal with the hair?
Yeah, so the uncut hair, it was like a visible symbol
okay.
of their separation to God.
Okay.
And avoiding contact with dead bodies ensured that they remained ritually pure.
So it was all about, like, the outward signs of their commitment.
Yeah, but I also think it wasn't just about appearances, because the restrictions, they were meant to help the Nazirite really focus on their relationship with God. You know, cultivate some self-discipline, deepen their faith
yeah.
through these very physical and spiritual practices.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like giving up something you love for Lent.
Right. Right.
It's a way to show your devotion and refocus your attention on what matters most.
Absolutely.
But it is interesting that the Nazirite vow was temporary.
It was, yeah.
It wasn't a lifelong commitment.
Right. Not like becoming a monk or a nun.
Exactly.
It was a concentrated period of time of devotion after which they could go back to their normal life.
Right.
You know, but hopefully having been transformed by that experience.
I wonder if that makes it like more appealing to people.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, you commit for a limited time.
Yeah.
You push yourself spiritually.
Right.
And then you can, you know, go back to your regular routine, hopefully transformed.
Right.
By the experience. I'm kind of curious to hear what our listeners think.
Yeah, me too.
Would you take the Nazirite vow?
What do you think?
What aspects of it would be most challenging for you?
Yeah.
Hold that thought, because we are going to dive into some more fascinating stuff right after.
All right, let's do it.
More numbers.
Okay, so we're back and ready to tackle more numbers. And speaking of numbers, there's one chapter that really stands out, number 7.
Oh, yeah.
It describes the offerings brought by each tribe at the dedication of the tabernacle, but it goes on for 89 verses.
89 verses of offerings.
And get this, each tribe brings the exact same offering. Talk about repetitive.
Well, it might seem repetitive at first glance, but I think there's a deeper meaning there.
Okay, what do you think?
Well, think about it. Even though the offerings are identical, the text meticulously lists each one. Like, God is personally interested in every single tribe and their contribution.
So it's not just about the gift itself, but the individual act of giving. Yes, exactly. It's highlighting the importance of every individual's participation in worship. Everyone matters.
That's a really cool way to look at it. Like, everyone has a role to play, and even small acts of devotion, they add up to something much greater.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's move on to a different situation, a real dilemma, you could say. Numbers 9 talks about the second Passover. Observing Passover was a massive deal for the Israelites, right?
Age.
But what happened if someone was ritually unclean because they had, like, come into contact with a dead body?
That's the dilemma. They're caught between these two important commandments, you know, observing Passover and adhering to the laws of ritual purity.
Yeah.
And breaking either one had some serious consequences.
So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. What was the solution?
Well, God, in his compassion, he provides a way out. He institutes a second Passover a month later, specifically for those who couldn't participate in the first one due to, you know, these unforeseen circumstances.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It just shows that the law, it wasn't meant to be this rigid, unyielding system. There's, like, flexibility built in.
Yeah.
A recognition that life is complicated.
It is.
It's kind of echoing Jesus' statement that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath.
Yes.
The law was meant to serve human well-being, not to trap people in impossible situations.
Exactly. And it's such a beautiful picture of God's grace and understanding.
It's a good reminder, I think, that sometimes, you know, we can get so caught up in the rules that we miss the bigger picture, the spirit of the law, the heart of God. Okay, moving on. Numbers also talks about how the Israelites were guided on their journey out of Sinai.
right? They had the pillar of cloud and fire, which, led the way during the day and the night. And then you have those silver trumpets, which were used to signal the different movements and the gatherings of the people.
Okay.
So you can really see, even in the wilderness wanderings, how God is present.
Yeah.
He's guiding them.
It's like having a divine GPS and a PA system all rolled into one. Talk about high tech. Okay, so let's fast forward a bit to a story that always fascinates me. The incident with Balaam. We've got this Moabite king, Balak, who's terrified of the Israelites, right?
Right.
So he tries to hire this guy, Balaam, a pagan soothsayer, to curse them. Things don't quite go as planned.
No, not at all. And I think what's so fascinating is that Balaam, even though his intent is to curse the Israelites, he ends up blessing them.
Yeah.
But it's even more fascinating because of what he says.
Okay.
Like when he's blessing the Israelites, he mentions the shout of a king and a scepter arising from Israel.
Oh, foreshadowing alert.
Foreshadowing alert. And it's so interesting because it points toward the eventual rise of kingship in Israel, and particularly like under King David, who we know conquers both Moab and Edom. So even in the midst of their wilderness wandering, those seeds of Israel's future as a nation, they're already there.
Right. It's like God's plan is unfolding even when things seem chaotic. There's a bigger story playing out. Okay, so let's shift our focus now to Deuteronomy, which is basically Moses's farewell address to the Israelites
Right.
before they enter the Promised Land. And just to clarify for our listeners, it's called Deuteronomy because of this Greek mistranslation meaning second law,
Right.
but it's not a different law.
It's not.
Just a powerful restatement, I think.
It's a restatement, it's a reminder,
Yeah.
and it's Moses's last appeal to his people to really follow God.
And that emphasis on relationship is crucial because the Israelites were about to face, I mean, let's be real, a whole new set of challenges in Canaan, like the temptation of idol worship, different cultural practices, the risk of forgetting God amidst all the newness and abundance.
Right. And that's why Moses comes back to this core message of love.
Yeah.
He's not saying, hey, here's all these rules and you better follow them. He's saying, love God, because when you love God, the rest will fall into place.
It's like he's saying, look, guys, this isn't about checking boxes. This isn't about following a bunch of rules out of fear. This is about a deep personal connection with God that flows from love and gratitude.
Exactly. And that's captured so beautifully in Deuteronomy 6.4 to 5 Shema, where Moses says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your
Oh,
strength."
I love that. It's a call to like wholehearted devotion, a love that just permeates every aspect of life.
Every part of your
And
life.
that love extends outwards too,
Of
right?
course, it's
No.
not just about us and God.
Right.
It's about how we treat others. True love for God spills over into love for our neighbor. You can't have one without the other.
It's like Jesus said, the greatest commandments are to love God and love your neighbor.
Yeah.
Everything else flows from that. Now, Van Noy points out that Deuteronomy 11, it beautifully kind of summarizes Moses' message. Right. It highlights God's mighty acts on behalf of Israel, and then the command to love and obey him, followed by the blessings of obedience, and then the consequences of disobedience.
It's like he's laying it all out. Here's the deal. You choose to follow God, you get the blessing. You choose to disobey, there are
It's not sugarcoating anything. It's like a vivid picture of what's at stake.
Absolutely. And it all comes down to this: choosing life.
Choosing life.
Yes.
And that's exactly what Moses urges them to do in Deuteronomy 30, right?
Yes. He reminds them that God's commands are not too difficult. They're not out of reach. He says, "The word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so you may obey it." And then he says, "Now choose life, so that you and your children may live, and that you may love the Lord your God. Listen to his voice and hold fast to him. For the Lord is your life, and he will give you many years in the land he swore to give to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob."
What a powerful reminder that we have this choice, every single day. We can choose life. We can choose love. We can choose this path that leads to blessing and fulfillment. It's not about earning God's favor or following a bunch of rules out of fear. It's about embracing this relationship with a God who loves us and wants what's best for us.
I love that. It's about aligning our hearts with God's heart and letting that love just like transform us from the inside out.
So as we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I'm curious to hear from our listeners. How does this concept of choosing life, of love being the foundation of our relationship with God, how does that resonate with you? What does it look like to choose life in your own day-to-day experiences? All right, so welcome back to our final part of this deep dive.
Our deep dive into numbers and Deuteronomy.
It has been quite a journey.
It has.
Right. We've tackled these like puzzling census figures. We've grappled with these laws that just challenge our modern perspectives.
We've challenged those assumptions.
We have. And we've uncovered this this profound message of love at the heart of the covenant.
Yeah. It's amazing how these like ancient texts.
Right.
They still speak to us today. Like,
yeah.
They really push us to think differently about, you know, how we view God, how we understand justice.
Right.
And the choices that we make in our lives.
Yeah, exactly. We've talked about choosing wife, about loving God with all our heart and soul and strength.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that actually play out in our day-to-day lives?
That's the question.
I mean, our world is pretty different from, you know, ancient Israel. Right?
It is. It is. It's a great question, because if love is truly at the heart of the law, as Moses so passionately argues, then like it changes everything. Right.
Right.
It's not just about following the rules.
Yeah.
It's about living in a way that reflects that love.
Right.
Like in our relationships, in our actions, in the choices that we make.
Right. So it becomes less about outward conformity and more about this inward transformation.
Yes. And I think that's where it gets exciting, because we start to say, okay, well, how can I express this love?
Yeah.
How can I show it? How does this actually impact my life?
Yeah, it's like that saying, preach the gospel at all times.
Yeah.
Use words if necessary.
Yes.
You know, our actions.
Right.
Should speak louder than our words.
And I think that brings us back to, like, the second Passover.
Okay.
You know, God provided a way for those who couldn't participate in the first one because of ritual uncleanliness,
yeah,
to still fulfill the commandment. And I think it's so important, because it shows us that, like, God isn't this cosmic rule enforcer who's just waiting for us to mess up.
Yeah.
You know, he gets it.
Right.
Life is messy. We make mistakes. But he's always there offering a way back.
Yeah.
He's more concerned with the why behind our actions,
right,
than just the actions themselves.
It's about grace and compassion.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And that brings us back to like Moses's whole message in Deuteronomy. You
yeah.
know, he's emphasizing that these commands, they're not burdens.
Right.
They're not meant to weigh us down.
Yeah.
You know, they're guideposts, right? Yeah. They're pointing us towards life, towards blessing, towards a deeper experience of God's love.
It's like he's saying, hey, I'm giving you this roadmap, not to restrict you, but to help you navigate life and experience like true joy and freedom.
Yes. Like he wants what's best for us.
Yes.
And this is the way to get there.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Numbers and Deuteronomy, we want to leave you with a final thought-provoking question.
Yeah.
If love truly is at the heart of the law,
mm-hmm.
how does that reshape your understanding of your relationship with God?
Yeah.
How does it change, you know, how you approach your daily life, mm-hmm. your interactions, your choices?
And it's a question we have to wrestle with, you know? It's not like we come up with a one-time answer and it's done.
Right.
It's an ongoing journey.
Yeah.
Of saying, okay, what does this look like today? Mm-hmm. How am I living out this love?
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it sparked some new insights and inspired you to keep seeking and questioning. And keep diving deeper into the fascinating world of faith and scripture.
Absolutely, yeah. Keep going.